Following is part two of Father John Hardin's class on sharing the divine nature.
Now, the essence of the supernatural is right here. The whole course on divine grace, two semesters, is all about this. Because, while God, having decided to make creatures, even rational creatures, did gift them with knowledge and a free will, nevertheless, even the most exalted knowledge and the most intimate love of God on the purely natural level is not the knowledge that God has of Himself and the love that God has for Himself. And this is what grace is all about. We believe that God destines us, and we have to reach heaven to experience it. We believe that God destines us one day, and what a day. As I keep telling myself, and an endless day. No more nights. That's my definition of heaven. Eternal day. No more nights. We're in heaven. And that's the revealed definition of heaven. We shall, by God's grace, be enabled to know God as He knows Himself. Notice, not as much as. Get it? Because God is infinite. But the word as is part of our faith. Am I clear? We shall know Him as He knows Himself. We shall love Him as He loves Himself. Without our becoming, which is impossible, God. This is what, in essence, sharing in the divine nature means. We speak of the beatific vision, and the terminology is consecrated by the Church, defined. You notice which part of those two words is the noun and which one is the adjective. The noun is the vision. The adjective is the effect of that vision. What is the core of the core of the beatific vision? It is seeing God face to face. By the very expression, face to face, is a homemade term that John used, and we've been using it ever since because he ran out of words. It is not just face to face with another person. It is face to face with God. In other words, we shall see God in heaven as He sees Himself, not with infinity, because we are not divine, not completely, because we are not He, not exhaustively, not comprehensively, not entirely, but the manner or the mode or the way we shall know God is the way that God knows Himself. And our best analogy is the one that we have from our human experience on earth. the way we know ourselves. And that is surely unique. We go back, therefore, to the third attribute or set of attributes which we say is or are communicable. The first set of attributes in God are not communicable. They constitute the divinity. The second attributes are communicable and indeed communicated naturally. Thus, existence, life, intelligence, freedom, goodness, love. God has these. He shares them with us. And that is sharing of the divine nature, but naturally. We were now looking at sharing the divine nature supernaturally. And we were saying this sharing of the divine nature means that God shares with us by grace that which He alone has a right to by nature, namely the kind of totally unique and distinctive self-knowledge that, of course, no one except God has a right to. And we were briefly discoursing on the term beatific vision. Heaven is that kind of knowledge. It is called vision precisely because we shall see God with no creature in between, not even, and this of course beggars description because we're dealing with mystery, not even our own faults. Even our thoughts won't stand in the way . This is what the beatific vision means. There are certain terms which the church has over the centuries used to bring out more clearly, or as clearly as a mystery can be clarified, what it means. It is, first of all, a vision, because just as with the bodily eyes, the moment something impinges on our bodily eyes, we see it. We don't have to work towards it, unlike all other knowledge of God, which has to be reasoned to. We can now conclude to God's existence. We can argue to His existence. We can, by the use of all reason, become certain there is a God. Well, there's a difference between concluding to something and seeing it. The church calls this vision intuitive. Intuitive because it is not discursive. Thereby discursive, it would mean reasoning. On earth we must reason. In heaven, we won't have to reason to God's existence. It is called a face-to-face vision to describe the nearness between God and the human soul. It is called immediate vision for the immediacy even excludes having to use thoughts to think, because let's face it, now when we say we know God, we're talking about Him, and I'll use His name a few times to make sure that He is on everybody's mind. We're talking about God. the moment I use the word, and hopefully you are thinking along with me, the God you know is the God whom you know because you have him on your mind. Well, what's on your mind? Your thoughts. But your thoughts are not God. Whereas in heaven, there will be no creature, and this, by the way, is defined by the church, no creature between the Creator Spirit and the Creator. The nearest analogy that we have to that, which again the church keeps using and reusing because it's the best we've got, is the immediacy of our own awareness of self. Except it'll be nearer. Without, and I keep repeating, our becoming as Christ became in his human nature, hypostatically, that is, forming one person with the divine, God will remain God and we will remain we. We keep our personality and God will retain his three persons. We shall therefore see God. We shall know him. We shall understand him. We shall penetrate into his essence. We shall grasp his meaning in a way that unless God wanted to share this knowledge with his creatures, no creature, though rational, and though knowing and loving God, would never experience. Now that is the vision part of heaven. The beatific part is the results. Because if God will, as it were, enter into the mind and all knowledge, his entrance of reality into the mind, all knowledge takes in, all knowledge absorbs, all knowledge receives. That's what knowledge is. And we're set to have the truth on our minds when that which is outside the mind agrees what's inside the mind. If I think, and I've convinced myself that this is water, tasted like water, should be tasteless. If this is glass, and my mind says it's glass, I've got truth on my mind. So God, therefore, will first be known, and known as the truth, because the God who really is will be the God that we shall see. But if that's the taking in, if that's the knowledge part of heaven, and notice that's the noun, that's the basis. What's the result? The effect is in the will. The will is the outgoing faculty. If we take in with the mind, we go out with the will. Towards what? Towards that which we know. And we love nothing but what we know. We don't love everything we know, because we've got a free will. We can reject what we know. In heaven, then, we shall possess God by knowledge. and go out to Him with our wills in love. Be united with Him. Now here again, even as our human experience on earth is the best analogy we have for what, please God, we shall all experience in heaven, the nearest approximation to the knowledge we shall have of God is self-knowledge. The nearest approximation to the love we shall have for God is our self-love. And who doubts that this self-love is most infinite, most precious? It is so strong, so deep, that the Almighty, when He told us how we are to love our neighbor, commanded us to love others as we love ourselves, knowing full well that human nature, just because it's human nature, loves itself intensely. That's the way we're going to love God. But we're not finished yet. Because if knowledge is the basis for love, love is the only foundation for happiness. There is no other source of joy in heaven or on earth except in love. And if love means union, and it does, then depending how sublime, how noble, how great is the object of our love, we shall be correspondingly happy. God will then be possessed by vision, loved because the will be united with its most sublime object, in which, and the phrase of Augustine has been memorized for now 1500 years, our hearts are restless. That, by the way, is the only reason why people are unhappy. Their desires are not satisfied. And God makes sure that we don't forget there's more waiting for us than this life. One of the phrases, the other evening I was lecturing at St. John's on the spirituality of John Paul II, that's the course, by the way, and he was talking about martyrdom. This is the Pope, and he was encouraging his listeners, and of course through them the rest of the faithful, to not be too enamored of this world or of the good things of this life. And he used the phrase ad maiora natusorum. No matter how attractive or satisfying any creature may be, tell yourself, this is the Pope, I have been born for greater things. Isn't that right? So it's sweet. It's nice. I enjoy it. But watch it. And this is one reason, the main reason, in fact, that God sends us pain. He knows us. Oh, how well He knows us. If we didn't have pain, we would you believe us? We would idolize this world and make a god out of it, as enough people are doing, to warrant the statements. But yes, the union of any appetite with its object, and I've got to use this kind of language because this is the nature of our subject, if the union of any appetite with its object gives satisfaction, with the wealthy matron cuddling, as I watched this again along Park Avenue, cuddling a poodle in her arms. If the union of any appetite, whether body or spirit, brings satisfaction, then what union, the love of what object, will bring the greatest satisfaction? The union of the human will with the ocean of God. Good is that which satisfies. Is it any wonder, therefore, that the Church tells us to use the word beatific for the possession of this vision, for which all other desires were met? The only reason we have any other desires is that, humanly speaking, none of them would ever fully satisfy us to keep whetting our hunger for more, until, as Augustine says, our hearts will rest in God. The word beatific, not a common word, except by now we Catholics use it a good deal. It corresponds to the word beatify. And it means literally, beare in Latin means to make happen. Indeed, to make perfectly happy. So that we've covered the rounds. And what do you want to speak about? The vision is the knowledge which the mind receives in heaven of God. Love follows on that knowledge inevitably. And when the will is united with the object of its love, it is always happy. So much so that love and happiness are correlative terms. They really mean the same thing. Love refers to that which I desire, toward which my will goes, and joy means that which I experience once my will has achieved its object. Among the mystics, this is what ecstasy is all about. Momentarily, some for even longer periods of time, are literally lost in God. That's what Peter said. Was it the other day in the Gospels? Or was it last Sunday, the Transfiguration? Peter. Not everything he always said until Pentecost Sunday was smart. Sometimes he could put both feet into his mouth. But this time, Lord, this is his limited Aramaic vocabulary. He was no philosopher. Lord, it's good for us to be here. Let's stay here. And how thoughtful of Peter. Let's build one residence for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. He implied, of course, he'd have to have residences too. And then, doesn't the evangelist say he didn't know what he was talking about? He had a glimmer of a foretaste of the beatific vision. Again, the mystics tell us, none of them, by the way, let's remember this, no person before he dies ever experiences the beatific vision. But with some saints, God in his goodness, both to teach them and inspire us, has given them at least momentary experiences of some reflection of the beatific vision. And they tell you the language seems exaggerated. All the sufferings, haven't you read this yourselves? All the sufferings that they've experienced of a thousand lives would be as nothing compared to that one moment's ecstasy in being so close to God. When time ceases and you're literally lost in the joy you have by having what you want. Well, having said all of that, what has that got to do with participation in the divine nature? It has everything to do with participation in the divine nature. Because, as we have been saying all along, the primary effect of the indwelling Trinity is to enable us to share already on earth something of the experience that awaits us in the life to come. We are dealing, of course, with mystery. What we know is that what we experience now on earth is a slight foretaste of what God has in store, as we are told, for those who love him. You might almost say, if we love God on earth, he will love us in heaven. If we give ourselves to him here, he will give himself to us hereafter. We are, of course, speculating because we are in the realm of theology. But it is commonly held among theologians to explain this sharing the divine nature by saying that it is an anticipated beatific vision. And consequently, God, we believe, allows those, well, first of all those who are in the state of grace. If we're in the state of grace, we possess the divine indwelling, we share in the divine nature, and we have some foretaste of the kind of knowledge we shall have of God in heaven. We who have the divine indwelling share in an anticipation of the beatific vision in love, in the love of God. Now clearly, we're not yet in heaven. The safest statement I could make in this course. So the love will necessarily be a costly love.
This concludes the class on sharing the divine nature. Turn over to side B and push the play button immediately for the quiz discussion on the indwelling spirit.